This episode of CPR's Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the College of Law and the College of Music and Media at Loyola University, New Orleans. One of the more perplexing challenges in preparing for climate change involves industrial workers. These are the people laboring in factories, farms, coal mines, and other businesses that are either contributing to the climate crisis or they're being harmed by it. Often, it's both. On one hand, these workers need jobs. They depend on their positions to feed their families and support themselves. On the other hand, they're suffering because of it. And so is our planet. The industrial worker tends to work long hours under harsh conditions in an operation that's extracting resources and harming the environment. They get little support or benefits from their employers or from the government for that matter. Many struggle to make ends meet. Because of climate breakdown, these work conditions are getting even worse. They're hot, toxic, and frequently underregulated. Going to work can be unbearable at times. And as a result, not only livelihoods, but lives are at stake. The conflict of the industrial worker presents a tough duality, an appeal to restore health and salvage the earth versus the need to sustain a living. Can we achieve both? Well, as we'll discuss today, the answer is yes, but it will take some willingness to bend on both sides. Because fueling these inequities of want and need, economics and social welfare, is a culprit that we all know well, you and me. Our demand for constant growth and easy access keeps the smokestacks burning and the tractors churning. To those who ask, much is given.
The main challenge we face is coming to terms with the reality that so many people's lives really are completely dependent upon fossil fuels, whether that's for a job or whether that's for the price of the food they buy at the store, and we know food prices are going up. And so that's where we need good governance. There's no future in which fossil fuels are a main part of the economy. Investing in that is suicide.
Yeah, this has been something that has been around since we wanted to regulate any environmental externalities, right? What do you do about coal workers, or what do you do about folks in oil states like Louisiana, where I'm from, in a transition to cleaner energy?
The current food system treats workers as just one more resource to be exploited. Like, we go through the soil depleting it of all its nutrients, and then just, you know, once it's gone, and too bad. And that's also kind of like the approach to the fossil fuel industry. We use farm workers just, you know, till they're old and exhausted, and then we don't have any use for them. And so thank you and goodbye.
This is really, you know, sort of nothing short of diabolical if you think about it.
It's slavery by another name.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. This season, season four, we're examining the impact of climate disruption across the globe and how it's affecting you. I'm your host, Rob Virchik. On today's episode, the industrial worker. Men and women working in factories and fields, struggling in abusive conditions to meet our every need, and why countering climate disruption may be the solution they didn't know they needed. Most of us don't think too long and hard about where the electricity powering our television is generated. As long as the next episode of Ozark pops up on cue, we're happy. Similarly, we rarely consider who picked the apple we sliced up for a snack. When the sweet, tangy juice hits our tongue with a crunch, we're content. And at this point, we've heard about gas-guzzling cars and the pollution that ensues. We might feel bad about it, but we've got places to be. Behind our weekly shopping lists, our utilities and motor vehicles, there are millions of workers operating, sometimes without a break or a day off, all to bring us what we've requested. Some spend their days indoors in factories, others on a ranch or a farmstead, or even more buried in darkness, digging coal from the earth. These places of work often discriminate against these workers in terms of pay and benefits and position them in the crux of environmental hazards. As the climate crisis escalates, so does the plight of industrial workers. Yet, if you ask them, quite understandably, the last thing they want to do is lose their jobs. Herein lies the debate of today's episode. But before we get too far, let's start by looking at these workers, find out who they are, where they are, and also why the weather makes such a big difference in their lives. As you're probably aware, the fossil fuel industry is alive and well. A 2019 report released by the U.S. Department of Energy found that fossil fuels employed approximately 6.7 million Americans in 2018. That's an increase of 2.3% from the previous year. Overall, the fuel sector grew by 5%, with oil and gas employers adding the most new jobs. Even coal saw a rise. Biofuels, a somewhat misguided cousin of the industry, added 1,800 jobs. People depend indirectly on the fossil fuel industry, too. Those jobs trickle down a line to create more employment, mostly through consumption. Many of these companies form a base in a community where the whole town feeds off the business. In a different neck of the woods are the farm workers. They labor daily in fields and processing plants. The U.S. Department of Agriculture released a similar report in 2019 that found that this sector employed 22.2 million people. If you include those in the fishing and shellfish industry, you can add another 65,000 or so. Basically, a lot of people work in these sectors. It's one of the reasons that, despite the fact our resources are dwindling and industrial production does great harm to the environment, business persists. Overconsumption and a bit of ignorant bliss reinforces our reliance on fossil fuels and agribusiness. We want more. We want to grow at any cost. How that happens is irrelevant. It's particularly a non-factor when those suffering most have little to say in the matter, and those doing the damage hold the power. According to a report by Oxfam, the richest 10% of the world's population are responsible for 52% of cumulative carbon emissions, and they ate up 31% of the world's carbon budget. Where there's demand, there are people who are paid a lot to supply it. For a good return on investment, there are even more people who are paid not very much money to make it happen. As a result, not everyone in these industries feels the burden of climate disruption the same. Like we've seen consistently through this season, those most vulnerable are the underpaid, the overworked, and commonly disregarded members of communities. Neza Shiatnakutni is the research coordinator for the Farm Workers Association of Florida, an organization advocating on behalf of farm workers' rights in the state. A majority of the workers he represents are immigrants from Mexico, Central America, and Haiti. Their living conditions often as poor as their workplace.
Most of our members are domestic workers. They're immigrants. Most of them don't have work authorization. They do live in permanent housing, but there is a shortage of affordable housing. So oftentimes they end up living together like a couple of families in one unit. They are vulnerable to whenever there's a hurricane. They don't really have a place to evacuate to. Some people, even though they may live in permanent housing, do run the risk of flooding. Although we don't work with a lot of H-2A guest workers, they do live in less permanent facilities, and those are more like labor camps. So they're also in crowded conditions, 15 or 20 people like sharing one cabin or one space.
If their home life sounds stifling, consider what they face on the job. For men and women working in factories that produce fossil fuels, exposure to toxic chemicals can lead to all kinds of chronic illnesses, from asthma and cancer to infectious diseases. These operations create dangerous emissions polluting the air, enhancing the greenhouse effect and causing temperatures to rise. Meanwhile, they're supported by minimum wage workers slowly dying in the process. According to the Environmental and Energy Study Institute, Such negative externalities are estimated to have totaled $5.3 trillion globally in 2015 alone. Then there's the matter of heat. Researchers at Stanford University, my alma mater, discovered that extreme heat is the leading cause of weather-related death, taking more than 600 lives annually. For those in facilities without proper ventilation and air conditioning, heat makes work nearly intolerable, and labor productivity takes a hit. A day with temperatures over 90 degrees costs one manufacturing plant more than $10,000 in output. By 2050, these heat-related manufacturing losses could equal more than $47 billion. Furthermore, extreme weather due to climate breakdown threatens production in other ways too, whether it be power outages, road closures, occupational hazards, mental stress, or other means of disruption. Take a step outdoors, the situation gets worse. The United Nations reported, for instance, that heat amplified by climate change could lead to the loss of 80 million jobs just in the next 10 years. The World Health Organization has said that this heat stress is likely to cause 38,000 extra deaths a year worldwide between 2030 and 2050. It can lead to heat stroke and exhaustion and aggravate other health problems too. Agricultural workers will be the most affected. They are 20 times more likely to have a heat-related illness than workers in other industries. They're also exposed to pollution at a much higher rate. According to NEZA, heat stress weighs heavily on both farm workers and their families.
The current food system treats workers as just one more resource to be exploited. Like, we go through the soil, depleting it of all its nutrients, and then just, you know, once it's gone, it's gone, and, you know, that's too bad. And that's also kind of like the approach to the fossil fuel industry. We use farm workers just, you know, till they're old and exhausted, and then we don't have any use for them. And so thank you and goodbye. A lot of farm workers don't have health insurance. They don't receive a pension after they retire, especially if they're being exposed to heat over time. You know, that those kidney functions evolve into hypertension and kidney failure, and often they end up with dialysis and needing dialysis in their later years. And that becomes a burden on the family. I mean, not that they see it as a burden, but it does become a financial hardship to have to care for somebody who gave their life and labor when they were young to feeding the rest of the nation, and then we're not really paying them back for their work.
Leslie Fields, the Senior Director of Environmental Justice and Healthy Communities at the Sierra Club, shares her own experience observing conditions on a sugarcane plantation in Florida.
One of the more shocking places I've seen is down in Belgrade, Florida, and there's a Rosenwald School next to the sugarcane fields. We still manufacture cane and cut cane or process cane like it's 1850. It's slavery by another name. You have contract workers, migrant workers coming from the Caribbean, come up. They live in camps. They burn the cane, and that brings out the rats and the snakes and the smoke and the contamination. Next to the school, they had to close the school because they could see the fires. It was very scary for the kids. The contamination's coming on them, the smoke's coming on them, and the community where they live in, which is right there too. And you don't have to do it that way. In Brazil and in Australia, they have machines to cut cane. And then you have the exposure to the workers have in the sugar mills.
Now, I did some research on the sugarcane industry in Louisiana, where I live. And I found that sugarcane is the third most valuable agricultural commodity. It's worth $1.02 billion. Many of the workers who harvest sugarcane suffer from chronic kidney disease associated with heavy workload, heat, dehydration, and pesticides. As Leslie points out, the industry is dependent on temporary workers from other countries who are often misinformed when it comes to contract negotiations. A lawsuit filed against one branch of farms claimed more than 2,000 seasonal Mexican workers received less than the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. The pay structure also contributes to inequities. Farm workers aren't typically paid by the hour. Rather, they're paid by how much they produce. That's known as piece rate. For those making barely enough to survive, there's no time to take a break from the dominant sun.
through the piece rate system. So they get paid by what they pick or harvest, and they sometimes end up pushing themselves, exerting themselves to get better payment for their work. So they end up not necessarily paying attention to what their body's telling them about, you know, taking breaks and going to shade and cooling off.
The EPA has outlined a number of climate-related occupational hazards, including all of those above, along with biological exposures too. Climate conditions such as temperature and rainfall affect the prevalence of disease, pathogen carriers, and allergens. For women, there's even more to worry about.
About a third of the farm labor is covered by women, and so some who have worked while pregnant and have gotten exposed to pesticides, they have had children born with some neurological challenges and deficiencies. And it's really difficult to link for them because sometimes they didn't know that those dangers were there. And especially if you're just being exposed to pesticides in slow doses over time, you can't really pinpoint it to a one time when you said, oh yeah, you know, that one time when we all ended up in the hospital. It's just more like an attritional effect on their health.
From NEZA's perspective, the way we treat industrial workers provides a stark parallel to the way we treat our land and resources.
The global interconnectedness of the food system, that answers to agribusiness and agri-corporations, is what is driving this model that wants to just extract as much labor from workers as it does from food, from the soil, depleting it.
Well, by now, you see the conflict. You've got an industry that's causing climate disruption. It carries a heavy bundle of climate-related stressors. But it also employs millions and millions of people. These workers depend on their jobs, and they might not be able to find work elsewhere. They're also being exploited as a result of all this. So what do you do? If you're the government, you enable the industry to grow in the form of subsidies and other policies. The Environmental and Energy Study Institute points out that the U.S. government provides both direct subsidies as well as other tax benefits to the fossil fuel industry to encourage domestic production, and that's estimated at about $20 billion in subsidies a year. Those tax dollars that you're paying are facilitating the production of fossil fuels at a lower cost, perpetuating a cycle of lethal emissions, unsafe working conditions, and energy and job dependency. And while clean energy technology has become cost competitive, it's not receiving the same kinds of subsidies. Maxine Burkett, a professor of law at the University of Hawaii and a member scholar of CPR, has brought up the idea of climate-related reparations once before on our podcast. Here, she sees yet another justification for that solution. She points to the fact that companies within this industry, most of whom adamantly oppose regulation, are responsible for more than the emissions they release. They're also responsible for the harmful outcomes that follow.
We are talking about an entire industry that has known of the likelihood and severity of a changing climate with a precision that is almost eerie in terms of its accuracy, knowing that there would be incredible storms, that there'd be threats to food security. I mean, knowing this for decades, even shoring up their own resources to guard against it, you know, standing up the most sophisticated disinformation campaign for decades, lobbying for continued activity. This is really, you know, sort of nothing short of diabolical if you think about it. And to then suggest that when all is said and done, okay, fine, it's happening, but we don't want to be liable and we want to make our own decisions about how we extract ourselves from fossil fuels if we choose to, I don't think it meets the requirements of any basic moral or ethical code. On the flip side, we are not able to provide the resources that's needed for so many more people that are suffering now as a result of it.
How do reparations fit in exactly? Well, maybe some of those subsidies could go towards training industrial workers to get new jobs. reimburse them for loss of income, a just transition, as it's known. Or they could be reimbursed for medical bills.
Climate change is getting worse, but the rate of change is also increasing. So there is no question that to do the just thing would be to make sure that we are within a climate system that we can have a hope to survive. Obviously, climate reparations are a big part of a plan. It's a Marshall Plan for all communities based on need, based on exposure to climate impacts, based on existing capacity. And one could even argue based on relative contribution to the problem. We've seen increasing data about the differences in contribution that show that Black and Latinx communities in particular are bearing the burdens of, again, overconsumption and disproportionate emissions from white and wealthier communities.
And with the COVID-19 pandemic, the discrepancy became even more apparent, as Neza Shiatnukutni points out.
Of course, the pandemic really brought out a lot of the inadequacies of the food system, but I think it really revealed that the lack of health protections for workers, and not just health protections, but how those health disparities are just built into the system because they can't stop working like many people cannot work from home. They don't have somebody to take care of their children. If they don't go to school, they don't have access to food the way other people do. And a lot of them live in what we often refer to as food deserts.
There's also the matter of farm subsidies, primarily subsidies for corn and soybeans, which present additional blows to society. For one, the tax benefit has created a monoculture in crop production. Why bother growing a variety of fruits and vegetables when it's easier and it pays more to stick with just one or two things? Subsidies have led to larger farms with fewer crops. More than a third of cropland is on farms bigger than 2,000 acres, and half the value of farm production comes from them. These industrial row crops are unnatural and cause problems including land erosion and soil degradation. By contrast, a diverse farm replenishes itself because strategic crop rotation eliminates the need for fertilizers and pesticides. If you're only growing corn, however, you have to synthetically alter the land.
Factory farms are increasing the workload for workers, and with a greater focus on production, there's less concern for worker welfare. And so with that extra work and that intensity of work, of course, comes more exertion and less concern for their safety and well-being, especially when it comes to heat stress. And they know they're replaceable, so they don't want to show that they're weak or that they can't do the work. And so they push themselves to work harder than they really should. I have heard them say that they don't feel safe against retaliation if they speak out against going into places that have just sprayed pesticides. Some of them have told me that they've been blacklisted for speaking out.
With all the money in corn and soy, farmers are producing so much of these industrial crops that there's a big surplus, and it's getting repurposed in questionable ways. Livestock used to roam pastures and eat grass, now they're trapped in factory farms feasting on corn doused with chemicals and blended with hormones to enable digestion and speed up growth. These animals emit methane gas, which is a big reason factory farms are responsible for almost a fifth of greenhouse gas emissions, more than all forms of transportation combined. In fact, livestock production and growing grain to feed livestock is on track to crush half the world's carbon budget by 2050. Government mandates also encourage farmers to harvest crops for biofuels. That means more land that shouldn't be farmed on gets devoted to growing corn. Biofuels are controversial, however. Some scientists think that they can reduce carbon output by as much as about 50%, while other scientists aren't convinced of that and actually think the opposite. A more recent study by scientists at the University of Michigan Energy Institute estimate that powering a vehicle with ethanol made from corn might cause more carbon pollution than a vehicle just using plain gasoline. Still, with all that repurposing, there's just too much corn. So it's going in your food, too. Almost anything you can think of, making it less nutritious and highly caloric. Cornstarch, hydrogenated corn syrup, oils, alcohols, If you start checking the label on what you eat, you'll be surprised how much corn you eat. Now, as we've already pointed out, a large percentage of agribusiness workers are Black and brown people. That includes immigrants and full-time laborers. Several thousand more are temporary workers brought in annually through the government's H-2A work visa program. And many more are actually undocumented. All these populations historically have had little bargaining power. Their roles on the farm include administering antibiotics to animals, clipping teeth, castrating, cutting off beaks, treating or killing sick livestock, packing animals for slaughter, and maintaining the land. They're subject to abnormal levels of particulate pollutants, as well as ammonia and hydrogen sulfide gases. They regularly operate dangerous machinery and are known to contract diseases from animal carcasses. And all these undertakings happen in record-breaking temperatures, soaring into the triple digits thanks to climate disruption. It's a cyclical pattern of turmoil that gets swept out like the excrements of an outdated, misguided policy.
What we want is this, for the system to be less extractive, less profit-driven, and more locally sourced, because then you have workers who are part of the community and who have better control over where their food comes from.
Aaron Bernstein, the interim director of the Center for Climate Health and the Global Environment at Harvard, and also an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician, he knows this all too well. He says subsidies are inefficient for the earth, for workers, and for us, the consumer.
You know, this isn't about the government spending money. This is actually about letting the market work. If we, in fact, priced fossil fuels appropriately for the damages they're doing to society, if we ended subsidies that are essentially incentivizing folks to do stuff that's unhealthy for people and destroying habitats and the climate, it turns out that the sustainable choices would be cheaper. And what's remarkable is that even with electricity right now in the United States, renewables are cheaper than any other fossil source. The bottom line is that if we simply leveled the playing field, this is not about government spending. This is just saying we have policies that say you want to put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that damages society, that costs us money. You're going to have to pay extra for that. The problem would shift very quickly.
What's stopping us from revoking subsidies or charging more for carbon output? Money, of course.
The challenge is that, you know, when we get into policymaking discussions, people want to say, well, what's the return on investment? We need to recognize that this is one planet, that it's very much more interconnected than it's ever been. And that, you know, particularly when it comes to climate change, we need to reduce emissions for the present so that we can deal with some health problems that have been hugely problematic in this country. We've talked about obesity as a good example. We also need to do it to protect our national security. We need to do it to protect the risk of infectious disease transmission around the world.
The story of the laborer becomes even more complicated when you consider the fact that with a shift to cleaner energy, there may be job loss in the market or a change in demand. Yet without climate mitigation, there will also be job loss, and it will be more substantial. Data shows that without global greenhouse gas reduction, labor hours in the United States are projected to decrease due to increases in extreme temperature. Over 1.8 billion labor hours are projected to be lost in 2100, and that's going to cost an estimated $170 billion in lost wages. On the other hand, with proper relief efforts, an estimated 1.2 billion labor hours and $110 billion in wages could be saved. Another report by the National Institute of Health suggests that reduction in the ozone standard currently being considered by the EPA would translate into an annual cost savings of about $700 million. So, what does climate mitigation look like in terms of labor and marketplace? Generally speaking, there will be a shift from the fossil fuel and biofuel industries to clean energy. Things like wind and solar power, and even nuclear power, will become more important. Eventually, we will no longer be reliant on coal, oil, and gas. Vicky Arroyo, a professor at Georgetown Law and the executive director of the Georgetown Climate Center, explains it well.
So if you think about our move away from fossil energy for purposes of powering our homes and businesses, you know, we're moving away from burning coal for all the right reasons. And that's even with the deregulation in this administration. We're moving to renewables like wind and solar. Prices have come down quite a bit. Of course, fracking natural gas and the availability of natural gas that's cheaper has also helped shift away from coal. But natural gas still is carbon-based. And ultimately, we need to move away from that as well. And nuclear is something that is actually, you know, very good from a carbon and climate perspective, but raises other concerns for people regarding disposal of the waste, for example, or the potential for accidents. But other opportunities to really expand the scope of what we can do with wind and solar power nearby is to have a place to store that energy.
The move to cleaner energy may begin by limiting and charging for emissions, making it simply too costly to continue with business as usual. It's a concept Vicky's been researching as part of her work for the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative.
The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is a program that caps the emissions from the power sector, and companies have to buy allowances to emit what they do emit under the cap. And it really has resulted in substantial net benefits to the tune of billions in the region. And those billions have been plowed back into the communities and into households in the communities. And with the money that's raised from that program, the states plow that back in to weatherization programs, energy efficiency programs, renewable energy programs, and things that help people get off of fossil energy.
Even with money going back into the community, however, the push towards energy efficiency hasn't boded well in the opinion of those working in fossil fuels. Earlier this year, coal workers protested at the Maryland Senate against a bill that would phase out the state's remaining 6 coal-fired power plants. The bill included grant money for displaced workers and affected communities, but it didn't go far enough for union marchers. Coal mining jobs were already slashed by about 50% this past decade, they said. This caused local economies to collapse. Companies went bankrupt. More people lost jobs. Now they feel pitted against environmentalists. If you ask Aaron Bernstein, it's a matter of miscommunication.
The conversation has been too much, and we've heard this in presidential conversations, which we want to kill coal. I don't want to kill coal. I don't. I want to create the future that is the best for everybody, including people who are working in coal, recognizing that we don't have a choice. I mean, I wish we did. And as a clinician, I see this very clearly, which is, you know, I'd love not to treat cancer, but it would be irresponsible if it were a childhood cancer that we can cure in 99% of the cases with existing drugs. I can't just stand by and you know, heaven forbid there were a parent who said, I don't want to treat my child's leukemia because I just think, you know, I don't believe in drugs. That's just not okay. And that's kind of the problem we face with climate change is we've got lots of people who have got good paying jobs. No one is here to question how important fossil fuels have been to everyone's welfare and are to everyone's welfare right now. The question is, what are we doing from this day moving forward? And to act as though we can continue with business as usual, or that we're going to have the holy grail of carbon capture or direct air capture, one of these technologies that hasn't really been brought to scale or is cost effective, come on down at some point in the future, is betting everyone's life on luck.
Vicky agrees. She says there's already extensive plans in place to take care of workers in the transition to cleaner energy and to involve them in the process. This joint effort or open conversation could provide for a smoother shift.
You know, this has been something that has been around since we wanted to regulate any environmental externalities, right? What do you do about coal workers or what do you do about folks in oil states like Louisiana, where I'm from, in a transition to cleaner energy? The bills that I've worked on over the years often had provisions for allowance allocation, resources from the allowances under a cap to be invested in training or retraining, you know, buying out some of the workers in these careers. Often, you know, they're relatively older members of the workforce anyway. So if you basically pay them, you know, a living wage for what they would have done for the last several years of their lives, from working and getting them to their pensions. That would help to precipitate a more fair and just transition.
And of course, as any doctor will tell you, prevention is better than treatment.
Look at cars. You know, cars were death traps in the 1960s, and now they have airbags and seatbelts and all these features that prevent harm. We have prevented actually heat-related deaths. So heat-related deaths in the United States have been falling year upon year. Prevention is not a problem for our species until the point at which I think it appears to cause pain to our direct economic welfare. So the challenge we face with something like climate change is that so many lives are directly embedded in fossil fuel production, extraction, and goods, and our food system is so heavily embedded in fossil fuels, that moving off of that creates turmoil for lots of folks, and most of all for the folks who are in the business of producing these fuels. The main challenge we face is coming to terms with the reality that so many people's lives really are completely dependent upon fossil fuels, whether that's for a job, whether that's for the price of the food they buy at the store, and we know food prices are going up. And so that's where we need good governance. There's no future in which fossil fuels are a main part of the economy. Investing in that is suicide.
So, are you ready? It's time for the good news. As we've already suggested, clean energy may actually create new and improved jobs, breathing fresh air into the economy and the community. In 2018, the energy efficiency sector produced the most new jobs of any energy sector, over 76,000, 2.3 million in total. Jobs may be in development, sales, production, distribution, marketing, installation, and servicing, all driven by the demand for efficient technology across many industries. Think of it broadly, too. Many of us already purchase more efficient light bulbs and electric cars. Electric bikes and scooters are taking off in major cities. There are companies and organizations focused on the concept of a regenerative economy, the goal not being growth, but replenishment. These efforts eliminate waste, support better products and resources, and offer jobs that aren't detrimental to the welfare of their employees. They create incentives to battle climate change, support new sectors of industry, and most importantly, change mindsets. With a new perspective, it will be much easier to get policies enacted. Aaron Bernstein is optimistic.
Despite what's gone on in the federal government, we've seen real progress in many parts of the country. The states with the highest penetration of renewable energy sources as a source of their electricity are not California or Washington or Massachusetts, and they're not even Texas, which has a tremendous amount of wind generation. They are Nebraska, Iowa, and Kansas, because it's cheap and it's profitable. And oh, by the way, it's saving lives because they're not burning coal or oil. And of course, they're not producing carbon emissions. We've seen a real recognition of the need to deal with obesity in ways that go beyond telling people not to eat unhealthy foods. We recognize that our community designs matter. We recognize that food systems matter. We recognize these things, and people are really working in I think, very compelling ways to deal with them. And that starts with entrepreneurs who are basing grocery stores that essentially provide very affordable plant-based fresh produce diets to communities that lack any grocery store, let alone one that I think would be impressive in any community, to innovative ways of preventing food waste, which is both a nutritional and carbon problem. Ultimately, individual actions are not going to get us where we need to go. And states have really pushed on this. We see many states advancing renewable energy in compelling ways. We see efforts to decarbonize transportation systems, including along the Eastern Seaboard. States that are really leading on the issue of climate right now are at a strategic advantage. They will have the technologies and the jobs and the expertise that's going to be the source of the global economy in the century. So to not do that is really setting oneself up for being left behind.
Another idea, one that could be approached on the grassroots level, is what Neza Shiatnakutni calls food sovereignty.
The way that the food system is structured now, we don't really control what we eat. It's just really what is being mass produced and presented to us in the grocery store. Through food sovereignty, each community grows their own food, or at least can secure through their own connections access to food that may come from somewhere else.
We can start thinking about who's behind all the food we eat, the fuel that we put in our cars, the electricity that generates the light that we left on all day in the bathroom, the heat we blasted instead of putting on a sweatshirt. Someone had to get that to us. Let's see if we can offer them some support too. Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information on this episode and the stories behind it, visit our website at progressivereform.org. You can also find us on Twitter at CPRblog. And you can find us on Instagram at progressivereform, all one word. And if you like this podcast, please subscribe to it wherever you're listening. And give us a review, too. It'll help us reach new listeners who are interested in connecting the dots on important issues, just like you are. I'd like to thank our guests today, Dr. Aaron Bernstein, Maxine Burkett, Leslie Fields, Vicky Arroyo, and Neza Shiatnakutni. Thanks also to our producer, Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer, Brian Gum. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Verchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.